Good evening, everyone. Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us at this medical ethics conference. We're very honored to have such a panelist with us. I just wanted to clarify something and say that when in some of the postings it said that you'll be hearing tonight from some of the world's greatest experts on medical ethics, that was not referring to me. It was referring to Professor Applebaum and Professor Prager. So we're very honored to have them, and we're going to be discussing a topic that's very timely, very much in the headlines, the challenges of medical privacy in the digital and genomic age. I'd like to thank Dr. Rubin for helping a lot of this happen, and our president, Anne Goldrush, for being very supportive of this. We're going to start with hearing from Professor Paul Applebaum. Then we'll hear from Professor Prager, and then I'll speak for a few minutes, and then we will have time for questions and answers. When panels like this happen, usually the interest comes mostly from the question and answers. People really have a lot of questions, so we're going to make sure to leave time for that after we speak. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Professor Applebaum, who is the director of the Center for Research on Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications of Psychiatric, Neurologic, and Behavioral Genetics at Columbia University. He also happens to be a member of our synagogue. We're very honored to have him with us. So, Professor Applebaum, please.
So hi, everybody. Ken Prager and I agreed we were going to divide things roughly in the following way. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the theory underlying medical confidentiality, where it comes from, what justifies it, some of the ethical and legal underpinnings of medical confidentiality today. He's going to talk a little bit about some cases that raise challenging issues that relate to confidentiality. So let me start by saying something about the foundations of medical confidentiality. For those of you who are familiar with the Hippocratic Oath, which of course was not written by Hippocrates, but probably in the early Christian era, you know that the oath says, whatever I see that shall not be spoken of abroad, I shall not reveal. So it's the first, oldest formal statement of confidentiality in medicine. Now, many scholars today think that the oath, and including this statement about confidentiality, was a marketing technique for a group of physicians of the era. That is, in those days in Greece, physicians were peripatetic. They came around to your town on market day, and they set up a little booth, says, the doctor is in, 5 cents. And they diagnosed and treated, and then the next day they moved on. Well, how could you trust a physician who you'd never seen before in your life and who was here today but gone tomorrow? One of the answers that one of these groups of physicians, the Pythagoreans, came up with was an oath to which they all subscribed. And the oath promised you that if you let them into your house, if you let them examine you, they would not seduce your servants. They would not induce an abortion in your wife. They would not cut on you, perform surgery of the era. Among other things, they would not breach your privacy. Whatever they saw in your house, whatever you told them that might be embarrassing to you, they would keep that to themselves. As medicine progressed, the obligation of respecting patients' confidentiality became generalized well beyond the Pythagorean group of physicians, and it came to be seen as one of the important ethical principles underlying medical ethics in general. And the justifications for confidentiality, the duty of confidentiality, come in two flavors, if you will. One is a strictly utilitarian flavor. That is, it's the notion that unless physicians can promise their patients that whatever they're told will be kept confidential, patients are unlikely either to come to them in the first place or to be fully forthcoming if they do. And so from that perspective, a consequentialist perspective, confidentiality is necessary for effective medical treatment because it provides a condition without which such treatment would not take place. And when you think of some of the things that patients talk to their physicians about, including their sexual behavior, their consumption of alcohol, their use of illegal drugs, and perhaps other indiscretions in their lives, you can understand where the promise of confidentiality is important to that situation. There is, interestingly, relatively little empirical support for that proposition. Not that it's easy to test. If you ask patients how important confidentiality is to them, they will always say it's very important, and there are numerous surveys that have shown that. But the skeptics say, well, look, you know, it's all well and good, but if people are really sick, they're going to come to the doctor. And the promise of confidentiality is important, but not as important as diagnosis and treatment of a serious illness. So there's always been a tension from the consequentialist perspective as to how important a guarantee this actually is. But there's another way of looking at the value of confidentiality, and that's from a more deontologic perspective that sees medical confidentiality as a good in its own right. That is, it is good for society to have a protected sphere within which people can come to their physicians and talk to them openly and frankly, whether they would otherwise, whether it improves the outcome of the treatment or not. It is a good thing for society to provide that kind of protection for this relationship. The notion of the importance of medical confidentiality in our society has been adopted by and embodied in the law. And it's hard these days to talk about the ethics of confidentiality without also talking about the legal framework within which it operates. Case law, initially, judge-created law, recognized that the universal acceptance of the principle of confidentiality by the medical profession created a standard of care, a standard to which physicians were obligated to conform. And failure to conform to that standard constituted a breach of the duty to the patient and should harm result, could result in an action for malpractice or another recognized cause of action. And an example of the way in which this was applied comes from a Massachusetts case from a number of years ago called Alberts versus Devine. Legal cases sometimes have the most wonderful names. Many of you know that the Supreme Court's anti-miscegenation decision back in the 1960s was called Loving versus Virginia because the couple involved were the Lovings. Well, you've probably guessed by now that Devine was, in fact, a minister and went to Alberts to receive some medical treatment, and in the course of that treatment revealed that he had a little bit of a drinking problem. The doctor was horrified to hear this and wondered how well Devine could minister to his flock and went to the bishop of Divine's denomination to tell him about his concerns. Divine lost his ministerial position and sued the physician on the grounds that he had breached a duty that he owed to his patients to respect their confidences, and the Massachusetts courts, up to the Supreme Judicial Court, agreed and imposed liability on the physician. So what starts out as a set of ethical principles becomes incorporated into the law. Now, for many years in this country, the legal protections for medical confidentiality were based exclusively in case law. Some states then began adopting statutes, but the really big change comes with the first federal law dealing directly with medical confidentiality on a blanket basis, and that is HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which Congress passes, which went into effect roughly 15 years ago. HIPAA created for the United States the first general federal standards for confidentiality, and it is the dominant way in which most practitioners think about their confidentiality obligations today. The key aspects of HIPAA, again, reflect older principles. Disclosure of confidential information, patient identifiable information, requires the patient's authorization, except for use and disclosure directly related to patient's treatment, to payment, and the ordinary day-to-day operations of the hospital. When information is disclosed, in most circumstances, it should be the minimum necessary to accomplish the purpose for which disclosure is taking place. Patients should be told up front about the protections and limits of confidentiality. They have a right to access their records and account, get an accounting of any disclosures that were made. And so you can see HIPAA more or less embodies the standard approach to medical confidentiality with a set of exceptions that we can go into in the question period, but which I won't get into right now. It has always been recognized that as important as confidentiality is to the medical setting, it is not necessarily the most important consideration that applies in any given case. And so there have always been recognized exceptions to confidentiality, some of them embodied in statute. So, for example, medical professionals and many other kinds of professionals in this state and every state are required to report child abuse that comes to their attention. What about the value of confidentiality of the patient who may be reporting such abuse? Well, it's important, but it's not as important as preventing abuse. There's a weighing process that goes on here. Communicable diseases need to be reported. Gunshot wounds need to be reported. Stabbings need to be reported. And perhaps one of the most interesting issues, which relates both to my specialty of psychiatry and to the new world of genomic medicine that we're all rushing into, deals with the interests of third parties, people who are not in the room, who are not the physician's patients, but who nonetheless, it is argued, have some interest in knowing what transpires in the medical relationship. So let me say a few words about this, and then I'll be done, and I'll turn it over to Ken Prager. Third parties' interests can arise in a number of ways. So in psychiatry, this occurs most saliently when a patient threatens to harm another person. And the classical case that resulted in the evolution of American law in this area was a California case called Tarasoff versus the Regents of the University of California. The case dealt with a graduate student. His name was Prasenjit Padar. He was an engineering student from India who had been attracted to a young undergraduate at Berkeley, where this all takes place, Tatiana Tarasoff, felt encouraged by her, what most people thought was just good all-American friendliness, and felt incredibly rebuffed and angry when it was clear that she had no intention of engaging in a more serious relationship with him. He goes to the counseling service at the university, tells them how enraged he is at her, may or may not have said something directly about harming her, but it is clear he is very angry at this young woman. She at the time is out of the country. It's summer break. The psychologist who's seeing him and the supervising psychiatrist talk about what to do. They try to have him picked up by the police and committed to a psychiatric facility. The police pick him up and, you know, sort of do their own mental status evaluation and decide he looks okay to them. So they let him go. 3 months later, Tatiana Tarasoff is back in the country. He goes to her house, confronts her at the door. She's home alone. We don't know exactly what happened, but we do know that she ended up stabbed to death. The family, the Tarasoff family, sues the university and says, you knew that this guy was a threat to our daughter, and you did nothing effective to protect her. The case goes up to the California Supreme Court, actually twice, and the bottom line is the court says the family's right. When psychotherapists, as they frame the duty, but essentially mental health professionals, know that, or should know that, a patient is intending to harm an identifiable third party, they have a duty to protect that third party using whatever means are reasonably necessary, in the phrase of the court. Protecting the life of an innocent third party takes precedence over the value of medical confidentiality. And let me just conclude by telling you the latest way in which this tension is playing out today. A growing number of patients are having genomic testing, either on a screening basis, although that's less common today, or for diagnostic purposes. When you do an examination of an entire exome or genome, a substantial portion of the DNA of an individual, you will often find things that are potentially meaningful to that person. For example, you may find in our community that a man or a woman is carrying one of the BRCA mutations, the genes that cause breast and ovarian cancer in women, prostate and pancreatic cancer in men, and are serious and potentially life-threatening mutations to be carried. If I carry BRCA, my children have a 50% chance of carrying the mutation. If I had brothers or sisters, they would have a 50% chance of carrying the mutation. If my parents were alive, they would have a 50% chance of carrying the mutation as well. If I had nieces and nephews, they would have a 25% chance of carrying the mutation, not an insignificant risk. And so it could be quite meaningful to them to know about this risk, which is fine and unproblematic if the patient agrees to inform their family members, which most patients do, and some patients don't, because families are families, and there are people who simply have had no contact with their sister for the last 25 years and don't want her to know anything about them, including their genetic risk, even when knowing that could lead the sister to be tested to find out her genetic risk. What does one do in a circumstance like that? The American courts have struggled with this issue. The ethics committees of the major medical associations have struggled with this issue. Interestingly, the ethics committees are more amenable to the notion that the physician may have an obligation to reveal that information, even over patients' objections. The courts have, in general, although there's not a large body of law on this, have focused on a single duty, which is the duty to inform the patient of the risk to their family members and to encourage the patient either to grant permission for information to be communicated or to communicate it themselves. But if the patient does not desire to communicate that information, the physician is stuck in this extraordinarily awkward situation. This is an issue we're still working out. This is an issue that I think will grow over time, and opinions on it may change over time. But it's sort of a contemporary example of really a continuing tension between the value of confidentiality in the medical setting and the interests of other parties, which gets played out really every day in our clinics and in our hospitals. So let me stop there. Let me turn it over to Dr. Prager, who will take it forward.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for the invitation, Rabbi Pupko, and thank John for recommending me. Thank you for that. Just a little personal note. The last time I was in this shul was when I, do you call it celebrating or marking your 50th graduation reunion from Columbia? It is a celebration, I guess, and that was about 5 years ago. And I came to Davin and Shul because I stayed in my old dorm that night, which seemed a lot more seedy than it did when I was there 50 years ago, I must say. It was called New Dorm, and it's got a nice name now, but it is seedier. Anyway, getting to the topic at hand, I'm going to give you a couple of examples of the way the issues and the conundrums that we have, the ethical conundrums about, on the one hand, keeping patient confidentiality versus a good that can be accomplished by violating patient confidentiality. And in almost all of ethics and the ethics committee meetings that we have, there are virtually always a clash between two good things and which trumps the other. So let me start, first of all, by, since we the title of the talk is Challenges of Medical Privacy in the Digital Age, has the digital age raised questions and has made things more complicated? The answer is somewhat, yes. I'll give you an example. If a VIP is admitted to Columbia University Medical Center and a curious doctor, medical student, nurse wants to know innocently what's going on when President Clinton was operated on at Columbia, people want to know how's he doing. Just in the olden days, pre the digital record, it would have been egregious for you to reach in and take the paper chart and to start going through the pages of President Clinton's chart. That would have been an obvious violation. But today, where we have electronic medical records, you can access a person's electronic medical record when you have the proper password and the proper password, and you can get in, and basically I have the ability to access virtually every patient's chart who is currently at Columbia University Medical Center. So if I want to know what's doing with President Clinton, I just go in there, and there it is. Well, of course, people realize this, people did actually try to do this, and there were other VIPs over time, and they got into big trouble. This is actually grounds for expelling the, taking a doctor's privileges away, severely reprimanding a student or a nurse and so forth for obvious reasons, But my point is that making a record digitally accessible makes it a lot more accessible than it was when it was just a paper chart. Now, of course, the hospital does take measures to prevent this from happening. When President Clinton comes in, he's not President Clinton, he's Joe Blow, and you really don't know who it is, and there are very strict measures that are taken to prevent access to the chart. I'm just giving you an example of the challenges that a digital technology has raised. But let's take this a little bit further. How about in the teaching institution? You are a medical student, and you come across a patient. Legitimately, you have access to their chart. This person is your patient. You take a history physical. You may even write a note. But then the time of your rotation expires. But you're curious to know what happened to that man or that woman that you worked up 2 months down the line. Is it still appropriate? And you can have access digitally to that chart. You have their medical record number, et cetera. Is it ethically okay to access that chart? How about 6 months down the line? You're really curious to know what happened. Where does enhancing the educational value of a follow-up of a patient morph into idle curiosity? I don't have an answer for you, but I can tell you that that is a challenge, and I can tell you that having a digital chart makes it even more difficult. And should you be reprimanded if it is found out that you accessed the chart 6 months later to find out what happened to Mrs. Jones, who was hospitalized with AIDS and had an opportunistic infection, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to be giving you a lot of questions. I don't have answers for all of these, but I'm trying to show you how complicated these things can be. Dr. Applebaum mentioned the HIPAA law. There's always a flip side to things. There is no such thing as something which is absolutely good. And sometimes the HIPAA constraints on sharing of information, done for a good reason, of course, result in what many physicians would consider obstacles to getting timely access to a patient's records. So hypothetically, if a patient comes to my office and I work up the patient then leaves, and there's a critical piece of information that I may want to get from that patient's doctor, and the patient has left, and maybe they're off in Florida or something, or I don't know where they are, they went on vacation. If I call up that patient's doctor and say, I need to know Mrs. So-and-so's EKG or chest x-ray findings, and if the nurse is a real staunch HIPAA advocate, you may say, well, we need to have the patient's permission for that. I don't know where the patient is. I can't access it. And the patient actually, there may be some harm to the patient in me not having timely access to that person's information. To be honest with you, there are times when, most of the time, a physician's office will be reasonable, quote unquote, understand that we can't have the patient at that moment, and understand they know me, and they will give me the information without actually the patient's permission, because clearly the patient had come to me for a consult and so forth. But it may vary, and there may be places which are very strict about that, and it can, in fact, impede or delay timely treatment and timely diagnosis. So again, a flip side to everything. Talking again about the clash between two good things and two rights. A number of years ago, the Ethics Committee at Columbia, which I chair, had an interesting case of a gentleman who came in having had a seizure. And this man had a seizure disorder, had had a seizure about a year before, and as a result of that, that had been reported, and he was not permitted to drive for 1 year. He had to be seizure-free for 1 year. And the patient, for one reason or another, omitted his medication or wasn't taking the proper amount and had a seizure just about at the end of that 1 year time. And he pleaded with the doctors in the emergency room not to reveal the fact that he had had the seizure. This was extenuating circumstances why he did not take his medicine. And this, and as you can imagine, a young person who needs access to a car, I don't know what his profession was, that this is a major issue. So what do you do in that circumstance? It's the person's confidentiality. He doesn't want that information known. On the other hand, we have to protect society. On the other hand, well, there were extenuating circumstances over here. And you can see how something like that raises some ethical issues, how strict to be. And interestingly, when we looked at the law in New York State, what was interesting is that different states have different laws regarding the obligation of a physician to report a patient's seizure to the, whether it's the Motor Vehicle Bureau or whatever. And when you would say, well, gee whiz, you know, ethics is ethics, and how come everybody doesn't have the same approach and the same law? It doesn't, and it will vary tremendously between between different states. The same situation with visual impairment. I give annually an ethics grand rounds to, of all specialties, ophthalmologists. You would not, ophthalmology, what kind of medical ethical issues do they have? They're fascinating medical ethics issues, and every year I come back and I learn a great deal from this. And this past year, the issue was brought up: if a physician is examining a patient and they are not quite legally blind, but almost legally blind, and the person is still driving a car, do you have an obligation to protect somebody from being run over because this person has such poor eyesight? On the other hand, confidentiality, without the consent of that person, do you have the, is it ethical to reveal that information? And here I should tell you my saying, which I often incorporate in my talks: something may be ethical to you, but illegal. And something may be unethical to you, but legal. And I mean, just to give you the obvious example of physician-assisted suicide, there are physicians in Oregon who may feel that physician-assisted suicide is unethical, but it happens to be legal. They are not forced to participate in it. Or there may be doctors in New York who feel that physician-assisted suicide is ethical, but it's illegal. And similarly, with this issue of patient confidentiality, an ophthalmologist may feel that it's absolutely ethical, it's incumbent upon me to report this person's poor eyesight and perhaps have this person's driver's license taken away. But if the law does not permit it, you could be sued for breach of confidentiality. And as Dr. Applebaum said, there are people who lose. So, and here again, the issue of eyesight and what your requirements are in terms of reporting will vary from state to state. Here again, you can see a difference. And I'll give you another example of how something that you would consider to be clear-cut ethics appropriate evolves over time based on the values of a society. And that has to do with the reporting of AIDS. When HIV was first discovered, as it were, when the cause of AIDS was first discovered, it was not treated as we usually treat a lethal communicable disease. Namely, in the earliest years of HIV, and we didn't know what the virus was and so forth, but in the earliest years, when a doctor diagnosed AIDS in a patient, it was not required in New York State to report this communicable disease to the authorities, to the public health authorities. And so a person could be engaging in sexual relationship with somebody and transmitting, at that time, a lethal disease. Today, of course, we have much better treatments for it. And the doctor could not do that because it was not required to report that. So even if somebody came to me, I diagnosed AIDS, the person's married, having sex with his wife, or the person comes in with a partner that he clearly is having relations with, and I find out the patient has AIDS, I had no legal requirement to report that communicable disease in the early days of AIDS, and people might contract it and die as a result. Is that ethical? I would say it was very unethical not to treat that particular communicable disease. If I have tuberculosis, it gets reported. Other venereal diseases reported. Why not AIDS? Because it was because of politics and because of the pressure that was brought, particularly by the gay community, to prohibit the transmission of that information. And the gay community felt that it was ethically appropriate to exert that pressure because people with AIDS were stigmatized terribly in the early days of AIDS. People might be fired from their jobs. Doctors would actually refuse to treat some patients who had AIDS. And so there were tremendous pressures brought upon the authorities not to make this a reportable disease because of the terrible consequences to the victims of the disease. But as a result, a basic communicable disease precautions were not taken. Over time, as AIDS became more, if you will, acceptable, understandable, average, people came out and personalities and celebrities came out, were not, and unashamedly, in order to destigmatize AIDS, said, I have AIDS. I remember Magic Johnson, the famous basketball player who came out, and other people as well. So we are very far today and in a much better place than we were in the 1980s when AIDS first made its appearance. And so today, in New York State, if I diagnose AIDS with a patient, that is a reportable disease. And if I ask that person if they have any sexual contacts, if they refuse to tell me, there's no way that I can force them to tell me. But if I happen to know that that person has contact with person X, Y, or Z, or is married, and I want to be sure that that person tells their HIV status and is taking appropriate precautions not to spread the disease, if I am not convinced that that person is doing what is appropriate and ethical, I can report that to the public health department and say that I have patient so-and-so who has AIDS and has a contact, give them the information of the contact, and the public health authorities will then contact the contact and say, we have been told, without naming an individual, that you have a close relationship with someone who has been reported as having AIDS, and then that person, it's up to them what they want to do, if they know who that person is, et cetera. The point that I'm making over here is that this whole issue of confidentiality and reporting and so forth has to do, it's not just a black and white ethical issue. There are values involved. There are societal values involved. How do we weigh the rights of the individual whose privacy we wish to protect versus the good of society whose well-being we wish to protect? How do you weigh them? And it may come out in different ways, in different circumstances, at different times, as you see from the issue of AIDS, as you see in other issues as well. So it's a constantly challenging area. Clearly, there are ethical issues involved. And the law, very often, is a reflection of our values and our ethics. And it may be very different in Mississippi, in New York, in California. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to the rabbi. Okay.
Thank you so much, Professor Prager. Thank you, Professor Applebaum, for sharing your expertise and knowledge with us. Very much appreciated. When you mention the topic of privacy in the context of Judaism, sometimes it surprises people. Because we know sometimes how privacy looks in the Jewish community. There's a story about a person who's sitting in a densely populated Jewish neighborhood. You can think about whatever neighborhood you want. And this individual takes out a ice cream and starts eating. And the neighbor calls out from across the street, you know, 1 hour ago, you just ate chicken nuggets. So how dare you do this? And so suddenly another window opens up and another person says, well, didn't you see they were parv? And so sometimes privacy in our community is seen in different ways. However, it's important to note that the aspects of privacy that pertain to medical ethics in Judaism are very different than they are vis-a-vis the legal system. When you have medical ethics as practiced through the legal system or through the medical system, those originate from a very different place. Judaism is a system of virtue, and so all obligations originate from within yourself. As opposed to legal requirements, they originate outside you, and as Professor Prager noted, it can vary from state to state. You're not going to have the same laws or even the same ethics in different states, as opposed to Judaism, where the laws originate from within you and you remain committed to, or sometimes torn between, different obligations that are coming from within you. And one of those, as mentioned, is balancing the needs of the individual versus the needs of the public. So if someone comes to you and they have Ebola, you have the obligation to them, but you also have an obligation to the community. So if you can take a look at your source sheet, there are some sources that have to do with the different obligations. The first is in a very professional setting. It's from the Talmud Tractate Sanhedrin, page 29, which speaks about privacy in a professional setting. It speaks about when the high court in Jerusalem decides about a case. Hagadol shebiyadei anim omer ish ploni ata zakai, ish ploni ata chayav. The chief justice says the verdict, whether one way or the other. And then the Talmud says, Uminayin likshayetze lo yomar ani mezakeh v'chaverai mechayvim, aval maya seh shechaverai ravu alai. You cannot say, if you're a judge in a court, I am the one who exonerated you, but my friends are the ones who are not, or the other way around. The court has to come out in a unanimous decision. You cannot go and divulge a secret. And it says in Proverbs, Holech Rachil Megaleh Sod. Then you have another source. Source 2 comes from almost every parsha in the Torah. It says, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe Le'emor. Why Le'emor? Why is it that the Torah also says Le'emor? Amar Rava, Minayin Omer Davar L'Chaveroshu Bebal Yomar Ad She'omar Lo Le'emor. How do we know that any person who hears any information from anyone is not allowed to say it unless they got explicit or implicit permission? Because it says, Vayomer Hashem El Moshe Le'emor. Every time God speaks to Moses, he says, and I grant you permission to share this. So the rabbis deduce from this that when you hear any information, and this is whether you're a doctor or not, when you hear information from someone, unless you get a license to share that information, you cannot share that information. And so that's a source that's very relevant to not only to the field of medicine, but also to each and every individual. It's codified, you can see in source 3, it's codified in Maimonides, where a person who shares information about someone else is in violation of Lo Teilech Rachil Ba'amecha, also quoted by the famous book of the Chafetz Chaim, source 4, where if a person hears any secret, they're not allowed to share it unless they were given permission. So that's the side of things that says you cannot share information. It's pretty simple, it's straightforward. Any information you get from anyone cannot be divulged unless it's explicit or implicit that you are allowed to tell it. The other side of the argument actually comes from a story we're all semi-familiar with, but not fully. There's the day after Rosh Hashanah, there's a fast. It's not just to lose all the weight from the meals we had in Rosh Hashanah, but it's mourning the loss of Gedaliah. Who was Gedaliah? Gedaliah was the leader of the Jewish people in Israel after the destruction of the first temple. Gedaliah got information, intelligence, that someone's on their way to kill him. And eventually he was killed by Yishmael ben Netanyah. That brought the complete end of the Jewish people living in Israel at that time. Every single person remaining in Israel was expelled. So the verse in Jeremiah says, the verse in Jeremiah implies that Gedaliah himself was somewhat responsible for the deaths that took place and for the tragic events that took place on that day. Why was he held responsible? So the Talmud says, because he got intelligence. He heard that this is about to happen. He was being very righteous, and he said, I will not accept Lashon Hara. I will not believe that. And the rabbis criticize him. They say, when you have information that can be critical, you need to act on it. So there's sort of a license that even though you're supposed to keep confidentiality, even though you're not supposed to speak Lashon Hara or accept negative information about someone, if there's danger to others that and you don't share it, then you're held accountable for that information that you didn't share. So that's the idea that the Talmud says we learn from Gedalia. The Talmud says, "V'chi Gedalia haragan? Did Gedalia commit the atrocity? V'halo Yishmael haragan? Yishmael was the one who killed them. Ela mitoch she'ayalo lachush la'atzati Yochanan ben Kereach v'lo chash ma'ale alav ha'katuv ke'ilu haragan." Because he should have taken into consideration that negative information, he's held accountable. So that's the idea of sharing information when you have it. So any physician or any person has to balance. On the one hand, you have this moratorium on sharing information. On the other hand, you have this obligation to share it when it can impact the lives of others. And that also has to do with the next mitzvahs. I'm going to go quickly so we have enough time for questions. The next two sources have to do with the mitzvah of Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa. Source 7, Maimonides says, Kol hayachol lehatzil velo hitzil, any person who sees someone drowning in the river and can save them, you can jump in and save them, and you don't, over al lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. That person violates lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. V'chen ha're'echa ve'ro tove abayam, ol istim ba'im alav, ol chayara aba, if there's a wild animal, the person's drowning in the ocean, anything that you see someone facing adverse circumstances, you should step up to the plate and make sure that you save them. So, in conclusion, you have all these sources saying that on the one hand, there's a moratorium. You cannot share any information that was not meant to be shared with others. On the other hand, you have a responsibility to others to act responsibly to help them. So those are the things to balance. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Professor Prager and Applebaum and other physicians sitting here for really every day standing up to the plate and making sure to fulfill this mitzvah of, on the one hand, Lo Tamod Al Dam Re'echa, helping save lives day in and day out, and on the other hand, trying to balance the patient's good with the needs of the community. So thank you. We're going to take questions now. If you have a question, please stand up when you're asking it, and please address it to whoever you're asking it. Okay, please.
Let me start you by saying something about the conflicting values involved. One is obvious, right? If people are going to be harmed, trying to do something to prevent that harm is obviously exceedingly important. But there is a value on the other side as well associated with maintaining confidence. And that is a little more subtle, but no less real. So if you want troubled people, maybe the very people who are at risk for committing harm against themselves or against other people or both, to come into treatment, there has to be some assurance that what they tell you within certain bounds will be kept confidential. Otherwise, we'll be in a situation where the very people you most want to have in the room there with you will never cross the threshold. So the question is, where do you draw the line between those two situations? And there's no algorithm to tell you how to do that. Prediction of future violence is very difficult. And we don't do it very well. By we, I don't just mean physicians, I mean society as a whole. There's nobody who does a very good job of predicting future violent behavior. When it seems fairly likely that violence will occur, of course, people will do something to stop, physicians will do something to stop. But when there is conflicting evidence or unclear evidence, lots of people are angry, lots of people talk about their hostility towards others in their lives. Very, very few of those people ever do anything actively about those feelings. And distinguishing those two situations is extraordinarily difficult.
I would just like to say, although in my own practice, I don't deal with people with psych, well, it's not true. Everybody has a psychiatric issue in my practice, but it's not why they come to see me. I just mean the normal flow of emotional things. But one thing I will comment on, I think when you have these tragedies occur, and then you read in the newspaper the next day or 2 days later, what if these idiots, how come they didn't pick this guy up? He did this, he did that, he did that. That's what I call Monday morning quarterbacking. I mean, maybe in some of those instances, there was a flagrant misjudgment on the part of people that that person encountered. But it's very easy after the fact to say, how come they didn't pick up this up or that? Whereas the 500 other people who exhibited the same exact behavior and did not act on it. And as Dr. Applebaum said, if we ended up reporting all of those 500 other people, you would basically have people no longer seeking attention. I would imagine it can be extraordinarily difficult, except in very obvious cases, to make that call ahead of time. And these are nuanced things. These are judgment things. So it's very easy to, at the after all of these tragedies occur, to say, well, it was so obvious. And so that's how I feel.
A question
for
Dr. Applebaum, the example you gave with the BRCA. Thank you. It seems to me, and that's very different from the case of someone who was going to do imminent harm to another person. The sibling, can you go ahead and test or decide not to test? That's just the fact that one sibling tested and defined that there was a predisposition or something, why is that considered to be something of great import to inform the other sibling who either will or won't be tested based on his or her own
condition? So the base rate of BRCA mutations in the Ashkenazi population, where we have these three founder mutations that particularly affect people of Ashkenazi descent, is relatively low. We hear a lot about it, but it's under 10%. Your risk of having a BRCA mutation, if your brother or your child or your parent is found to have one, is 50%. So the risk of being affected is markedly increased by that knowledge. Sure, every Ashkenazi Jew, in fact, every person, could seek out genetic testing. Most people aren't motivated to do so unless they know that they're at particular risk. And that's really what makes it a tough situation here. There's not a certainty of being affected, but the increased risk, which is a multiple of more than five, is what makes this an agonizing situation to sit with.
Thank you. To Dr. Pedro and Rob, can the doctor, physician, dentist, whatever, medical care provider, when in a conflict between what is legal and ethical in the state that one is practicing in, if that practitioner actually follows the recommendation of an ethical board, which, or ethical authority, that's what Rabbi comes in, which may be in conflict with an interpretation of the legal standard. Is that, in your experience, has that been a good defense?
Has that been a good defense?
Yes.
I think that the vast majority of doctors, even though they may feel ethically compromised in not reporting the situation, when the law does not allow it, the vast majority of doctors will not do so because they don't want to open up themselves to significant legal liability.
That wasn't my question.
Oh, what?
The question for the grand practitioner decides to follow the ethical.
Yes.
What is deemed to be the ethical imperative. And is that itself a defense when challenged legally?
Well, I think, you know, when challenged legally, it depends what the law is. What I'm saying is that I think I think it would depend on the judge or on the jury. I could say to the jury, look, I was doing what I think is ethically proper, but I don't know that that will, if I clearly violated the law, I don't know. I think Paul probably knows more about the law. I'm sure he knows more about the law than I do, whether that would be an adequate defense. If you flagrantly, if I report somebody when the law says you may not report somebody, and I say I did it because of ethical motivations, is that going to keep me out of trouble?
And probably not. I mean, think about Dr. Alberts, who told Mr. Devine's bishop about his drinking problem. He thought he was doing the right thing. He was helping the church. He felt compelled to reveal that information, but it certainly wasn't helpful when he got to court.
Just a halachic perspective I got from speaking to Poskim who specialize in this field is that often you do have situations where halacha says, well, this isn't something that you should do. However, in that case, an Orthodox doctor can say, well, the consideration of losing my job or facing legal penalties is something that will be taken into consideration. There will be cases where even that is not going to help, but definitely the consideration of parnasa or legal penalty is taken into account by post.
You're asking about vaccinations?
Yeah.
Well, as I said, really, in the previous question, I may have strong feelings about it, but I should know what the law is in that circumstance. Again, if I feel strongly that the good of the society obligates me to break confidentiality, but it's against the law, I could put myself in legal jeopardy.
Well, I was thinking more about not having but what should the law be?
Well, you know what? What the law should be, I as a citizen and you as a citizen, we certainly have the right to lobby our legislatures if we have strong feelings about that, and that medical societies do that. On Thursday, I will be going to Trenton, New Jersey, because I live in New Jersey, as one of a group of physicians to testify against physician-assisted suicide. because New Jersey is now considering legalizing it, and I have strong feelings against it. So I'm going to be down there, and I will testify why I think it's unethical and it's a bad idea. But should it pass, I'm sure the law will not compel me to participate in assisted suicide. I personally would think it's a very sad thing, the more pervasive it becomes. So we have the opportunity to try to influence legislation. We live in a democracy, though. We have laws. We have legally elected representatives. We have an opportunity to try to influence it. But once it happens, that's what the law is.
So let me, if I can, say something about what we've seen over the last probably half century in terms of the balance that the law has struck with regard to the interests of the public versus medical confidentiality. I think it's fair to say we have seen a steady erosion of medical confidentiality over that period of time. And the reason has been taking an issue, a single issue, one at a time. It always seems as though the harm to confidentiality is slight compared with the gain to the particular group at risk. So for example, child abuse statutes come along beginning in the 1960s. And you'd be hard pressed to find anybody who would argue that we shouldn't report child abuse today. But child abuse statutes were then joined by elder abuse statutes, disabled persons abuse statutes, and other vulnerable groups abuse statutes. Each one of them is hard to quarrel with. Taken as a group and added to communicable disease reporting and gunshot and stabbing reporting and other kinds of requirements. For example, in New York over the last several years, we now have the SAFE Act. The SAFE Act was Governor Cuomo's effort to respond to the Sandy Hook shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. It requires mental health professionals go online and report any patient who they think may be dangerous to themselves or to other people. That information is transmitted to Albany, where it's checked against a database of people who are licensed to carry handguns in New York State, and the police are notified if there's a match and have the authority to confiscate the handguns, although it's not at all clear how often that actually happens. But the requirement that mental health professionals report anybody who is dangerous to themselves or other people, a huge proportion of patients are having some degree of suicidal ideation. And many of them are having some degree of aggressive ideation. Only a small fraction, very small fraction, will ever act on those thoughts. But in a time when there was enormous concern about mass shootings, it seemed like a reasonable trade-off. And the problem is, it almost always seems like a reasonable trade-off, and the sphere of protected confidences gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
I think the communicable disease, though, I would quite agree with that. What I tried to show in the AIDS situation is how actually it has evolved to greater protection of the community now, where we must report that. So I think the community is generally pretty well protected against communicable diseases by our current laws. If you don't follow it, you don't report to the doctor, there's no way, obviously, of knowing it. But the question is, once a doctor is aware of that, what is the legal and ethical obligation of the doctor to report it?
Yeah.
That's a good question, actually. You know, it's a good question. So let's say I have a patient that comes in, and I'm taking care of a patient in the hospital, and that person has many relatives and friends. And I'm seeing the patient, and I come out of the patient's room, and some patient's cousin comes by and says, "Well, so how's my uncle doing?" What am I supposed to say? How much information am I supposed to divulge? I could say, "I'm sorry, based on HIPAA law, I need permission from your uncle to respond to that question, and I really can't say." Or I can say, "Doing okay," and they may say, "Well, can you tell me a little bit more," and so on. You see how it can get a little bit sticky. The truth is that I think the way most doctors negotiate it, or perhaps I should say should negotiate it, is to say nothing beyond doing okay or not doing so well, since they're going to go in and see the patient. If the patient's on a respirator and 17 drips and so forth, they don't need Dr. Prager to tell them that they're in bad shape. Or if the patient's up doing a crossword puzzle and sitting in their chair doing well when they came in comatose, they're doing well. Beyond that, though, I don't feel at liberty to disclose information unless I get permission from the patient. And there are times, I will tell you, when there are, especially in the Frum world, there are many community representatives who refer patients to me and to other people, and they then think that they have carte blanche to find out how the person's doing. And I will tell them, unless Mr. Morgenstern or Mr. Goldberg gives me permission, I'm really not at liberty to share that with you. So that's a good question. And I think we have to be careful lest we divulge that.
That's a big issue, Dan. And in the treatment of patients with serious psychiatric disorders, often are living with their families, and the families are the major caregivers. And the families are overseeing their care, making sure they take their medications, making sure they get to their appointments. When the patient says, "I don't want you telling my mother anything," that is an injunction that under HIPAA, as well as under traditional medical ethics, needs to be respected. And yet, it is clearly not in the patient's interest for the family to be shut out of that knowledge. Maybe not knowledge of exactly what they're saying in the treatment room, but at least what medication should they be taking, how often should they be taking them, when is the next appointment. And yet, one of the paradoxes of HIPAA is in trying to protect patients by creating this wall of privacy, we've sometimes ended up harming them.
I'll ask Dr. Appelbaum a question, because this is a big issue. You send your kid to college. The kid is going to the psychiatrist and has tried to harm themselves, or they've attacked some, or whatever, and the child does not want the parents paying $60,000, and the child is involved in some very serious emotional issues, and the child doesn't want the parent to know. How do you handle that situation, and do you think that the law is appropriate or harmful to the child, or what do you think about that?
So if the student's under 18, you can talk to the parents about that. If they're over 18 and legally an adult under HIPAA, they have the right to say, "I don't want my parents to know what's going on." Moreover, adolescents are, including late adolescents, are particularly concerned about privacy issues, and there have been any number of studies showing that they are likely to be deterred from seeking treatment if they believe that they will be talking to their parents. And, talk to one set of parents on a college campus, and all the other students are going to know that confidentiality was broken and be less likely to come in. Now, that
being said, there's a point, right? When somebody's acutely suicidal, really in an urgent situation, needs hospitalization, where confidentiality will be breached. But, you know, ironically, if you send a child to college and pay $60,000 a year and want to know what their grades are, you don't get that information either. That's a different federal law, right? That's FERPA. And there's no out there. There's no emergency provision to find out whether they got an A or a B in political science. So in some respects, that's even more highly protected information.
What are the patients that seem to have been incompetent?
Yeah, if the patient is incompetent, then if you think it's in the patient's best interest to disclose information to family members or other caregivers, you can disclose that information. There's also an interpretation from HHS of HIPAA that says that if the patient is there with you and fails to object to your disclosing information to family members, that's, you don't need an explicit authorization in that situation. So,
Let me just follow up on that a little bit. We've had situations where patients have made their wishes known. They don't want their HIV status to be told to anybody. They lose capacity. They're very sick. And their healthcare proxy, whom they've appointed, doesn't know that they have AIDS. And the interns and the residents and the attendings, share this information? Maybe this is relevant to decision-making on the part of the healthcare proxies or the surrogates. And so that can be a difficult question. The way we've handled it in general is that if knowledge of the patient's HIV status is really critical to the medical decision making that the person may have to make and that the patient's well-being may be harmed by not revealing the information, we would reveal the information. On the other hand, we have to be convinced that it is essential to be making an appropriate decision about that patient's critical illness. So it can be dicey in that circumstance.
All right, we'll just take, you didn't ask yet. There's going to be time a bit afterwards, but I see let's just take two more questions. Did you want to ask something? Or? Right. Okay, so I just wanted to really, on behalf of myself and the synagogue, thank Professors Prager and Applebaum for dedicating their time and outstanding expertise. Thank you so much for coming here. I'd like to thank again Ramato Ra and our president and Goldhirsch for hosting this. Thank you everyone for coming here. Thanks a lot.